We got some trade and some tariffs, maybe some taxes, I don't know. And while you wait for that, think about what you were doing 10 years ago this week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 16th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are going to be a whole lot of new faces at the White House soon-ish. You know that if you follow political news. There's going to be a new economic face as well, and that is where we're going to start the next 5 minutes of live radio on this program. Sheila Kolhatkar writes for The New Yorker magazine. Anna Swanson for The New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sheila, let me start with you and the new face at the White House. I guess Monday, is that when he's starting? I don't know. He's waiting on a security clearance, a bunch of stuff. Larry Kudlow, late of CNBC, formerly of the Reagan White House. You talked to him this week after the new job was announced. What is your sense of why he took this job, since he has publicly disagreed with the president on the new tariffs?
Well, my feeling about Larry is that he has been waiting for quite some time to find some influence in Washington. This is sort of his fantasy scenario. He was, a member of the Reagan administration. Right. He worked in the budget department. He's a classic trickle-down economics guy. He believes in aggressively cutting taxes for corporations and wealthy people and believes that the benefits will flow down the chain. This is a very controversial idea. But I think he saw an opening in Trump, an opportunity to have some influence.
Anna, I want to read to you, rather, part of Sheila's article about Larry Kudlow in The New Yorker the other day, the piece she wrote. And it said, quote, "In my conversations with the president in recent days, he's made it very clear he doesn't like tariffs either. I think you'll see targeted tariffs," Kudlow said. You actually reported on this a couple of days ago. They are coming against the Chinese, right?
That's right. So there is a new round of tariffs coming, even before the dust settles on these steel and aluminum tariffs that were announced that were announced the other week and are expected to go into effect next Friday. So the White House is preparing another big round of tariffs, this time aimed at China. And last week, Bob Lighthizer presented the trade representative presented the president with a package of tariffs of $30 billion. And the president apparently said that wasn't big enough. He wants more. So we'll have to see where those ultimately fall.
Sheila, let me ask you this, and I will grant you it calls for a bit of hypothesizing here. But why do you suppose, other than the big booming headline effect, which might be the whole reason, why did he go with these across-the-board tariffs instead of what Kudlow was talking about and Anna reported on, these targeted things against the main trade offender in his mind?
Well, I thought the reaction to the tariffs was sort of interesting. The people you would have expected to get very upset did get upset and cautioned about the possibility of a trade war and other countries retaliating. Those are all valid concerns. But as I saw one Ivy League economist after the other in pinstripes kind of screaming about this in various media outlets, I thought that, you know, Trump on some level, you know, knew what he was doing. This was sort of a political move. And he was speaking to his core base of voters, out of work steel workers. And it's not necessarily a huge constituency, but that was my sense. I mean, he just threw it out there because he thought it would play well with his base.
I'm sorry to cut you off. But Anna, as we are going to hear later in the program, the Europeans are not at all happy about being on this list. It is arguably going to call for some kind of climb down if the Europeans get really aggravated about this. Why not just go big on China and you know, as the president said, $30 billion is not enough?
Well, maybe that is why they're speeding into this next trade action, which many people in the administration are very united around, unlike steel and aluminum tariffs. People like Senator Marco Rubio or Orrin Hatch, you know, both men who oppose the steel and aluminum tariffs have welcomed action on China. And I think you'll see much more of a united Republican front, at least on the idea. Maybe when it comes down to what exactly we're going to put tariffs on, there will be more dissension.
Right. Let me change gears completely here and mention an interview I did, which I think I talked about on the program yesterday. Tim Geithner, Hank Paulson, and Ben Bernanke sat down with them earlier this week talking about 10 years since the financial crisis, the Great Recession. We're going to air that on Monday. I want to play a little piece of tape of Timothy Geithner, then the head of the New York Fed, talking about how fraught things were this week 10 years ago. As Bear Stearns went under. Here's Tim Geithner.
Until President Bush and Hank Paulson were successful in getting Congress to pass the emergency authority in September, early October, we were using duct tape and string to try to hold the thing together. We were doing so creatively in ways that had been done since the Great Depression, but those tools were very weak, and the capacity to maximize our power was very limited against the force of the storm.
My personal most holy cow moment of the financial crisis was when TARP was voted down in the House and the Dow dropped 777 points. I would love to hear from each of you in the minute-ish we have left, tops, what your most vivid memory of the crisis was. Anna?
Well, 10 years ago, I was actually in grad school in Nanjing
Wow.
in China.
Oh,
but
wow.
I do remember later that year, I got hired to a job in Shanghai, and I was walking to work listening to Marketplace and listening to all of it fall apart. So, yep, I was a fan
Wow.
back then.
Global crisis. Sheila, what about you?
Mm-hmm. Well, just a few days before Lehman Brothers effectively collapsed, my husband and I made an offer on a home, our first home. And I remember watching the stock market collapse and feeling a bit sick to my stomach. And then the realtor called and said to us, is your offer still good?
And
I will never forget that.
Did you buy the house? Did you buy the house?
Well, it took us two more years.
Wow.
But we eventually bought a different but very similar house and got it at a much better price.
Yeah. Sheila Kolhatkar at The New Yorker Magazine and Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Here's the plug one more time. Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson on this program coming up on Monday. Wall Street today, kind of run-of-the-mill. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the European Union this morning, a full 10 pages listing hundreds of American products that the EU might go after if President Trump goes ahead with those tariffs that Sheila and Anna and I were just talking about. Some of them you know about, others maybe not. Peanut butter, cranberries, sweet corn and ceramic statuettes, shoes, and various kinds of industrial glass. The Europeans are peeved. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
In Brussels, the threat of US tariffs on European steel was met with cold staccato fury.
It will hurt the European Union. It will put thousands of European jobs in jeopardy. We find that deeply unjust.
Cecilia Malmström, the EU's top trade official, she seethed over the claim that European steel exports to the US endanger American security.
We cannot see how the European Union, friends and allies in NATO, can be a threat to international security in the US.
Last year, the EU exported $6.5 billion worth of steel and $1 billion worth of aluminium to the US, making it the second largest foreign supplier after Canada. But Canada has been exempted from the tariffs, so if they are imposed, the EU could take the biggest hit. And the hit, says Charles de Lusignan of the European Steel Association, could be much bigger than just Europe's loss of sales to the American market.
Many of the same countries who are in the top 10 of US exporters are the same who go to Europe. For example, Brazil and Turkey are both large exporters to the US. They'll just turn their boats around and head straight to the EU. And trade deflection could have a much, much larger effect on the industry than the actual loss of exports itself.
Steel deflected from the US could pour into Europe, further depressing European steel prices. The EU is fighting back, hitting the US where it hurts. In its icons.
So bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry.
The EU wants to slap a levy on your Chevy, your whiskey, and your rye, targeting Americana. The Europeans are threatening their own 25% tariff on imports of some of the US's best known products, bourbon, blue jeans, and this. Harley Davidson's were put on the list. The company is based in Wisconsin, home state of House Speaker Republican Paul Ryan. In all, American exports worth some $3.5 billion could be affected. Fairly obvious what the Europeans are up to, says Meredith Crowley, a trade expert from Cambridge University.
They're hoping that by making these threats, they can get some sort of negotiated agreement with President Trump's administration to not include the European Union in this large import tariff.
They'd much rather Trump did not impose his steel tariffs at all because of the possible impact on the whole global trading system. The EU claims that the steel tariffs are not about national security, but protectionism pure and simple. And Mike Jakeman of the Economist Intelligence Unit says that undermines the World Trade Organization, which enforces the global trading rules.
Increasingly, the WTO becomes, you know, much less relevant, and the sort of global trading order starts to crumble a little bit. That's probably the big concern.
But some trade experts say the EU's planned retaliation flouts WTO rules and has provoked President Trump into threatening a 25% tariff on European car exports into the US. Financial markets remain calm. A full-blown trade war seems unlikely. But if one did break out between the world's two biggest trading partners, it could be devastating. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If the legal machinations of giant corporate mergers are your thing, next week is gonna be a good one for you. The United States of America plaintiff v. AT&T Inc. and Time Warner Inc. defendants gets going in federal court on Monday. The Justice Department is trying to block the $85 billion deal, and the companies are fighting back. Yes, this case does have a lot to do with the changing media landscape in which we find ourselves, but it also does say a lot about some kinds of big money mergers in the Trump era. From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
The fact that this fight is headed to court is pretty unusual.
A case like this has not gone to trial for many, many years.
Eleanor Fox is a law professor at New York University.
Mergers don't go to trial very often because they either get settled or abandoned when they're alleged to be anti-competitive.
The Department of Justice's move to stop the AT&T-Time Warner merger also caught some off guard because this is a Republican administration. Nanette Heide practices corporate law at Duane Morris.
Coming on the heels of the Trump election, business people really thought that mergers and acquisitions would flourish.
You know, pro-business, fewer regulations. So what happened? Heide says one factor: previous mega deals often required the government to step in and monitor the companies even after the deal was done.
So potentially, what the government could be saying is that we don't want to approve mergers where we're going to be required to babysit the transaction.
Another factor? Trump himself. Edward Mills is a Washington policy analyst for Raymond James Financial. He says businesses are weighing new dynamics when they consider deals under this administration.
I think you look to see if any part of the company that you'd be acquiring could be viewed in a negative political light from the president.
Because that might trigger a public backlash that could prompt the president to weigh in. Mills' advice to businesses?
Recognize that a deal that has any political hear on it has the chance that it gets blocked or is a tweet away from breaking apart.
Mills says if the government loses, we'll probably see a new wave of big-dollar mergers. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
mint extract, as well as a couple of other ingredients that he added, they're irritants. They cause our tongues and our gum to tingle.
Who doesn't love a little tingly feeling, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 72 points this Friday, 0.2%, 24,946. The NASDAQ rose less than a point. We'll call that flat, 74.81. S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.1%, 27.52. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.5%, the NASDAQ down 1.2%, the S&P 500 1% lower. Home builders closed higher today as Commerce Department figures showed more starts on single-family homes last month. Toll Brothers up 0.2%. KB Home climbed 0.6%. Online furniture retailer Overstock.com discounted 0.5%. The company posted a drop in fourth-quarter revenue, citing competition with rival Wayfair. Wayfair down 0.5%, because, of course, you're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer. Eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of the most common economic refrains of the Trump administration has been this phrase, quote, Obama-era regulation. The president and Congress have repealed or rescinded dozens of federal rules put into place under the prior administration. Now, there's a court fight brewing over another one after a federal appellate court ruling yesterday. It's called the fiduciary rule, which made it official that financial advisors and brokers have to act in their clients' best interests. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on here.
The fiduciary rule was created by the Labor Department during the Obama administration. It said financial advisors and brokers couldn't steer clients toward investments with hefty fees or commissions that might not be best for them. Before the rule,
financial advisors were allowed to effectively give sales pitches that were disguised as advice.
That's Micah Hoffman, an attorney with the Consumer Federation of America. He says the Supreme Court could end up deciding the fiduciary rule's fate. Hoffman's not convinced financial services firms will keep complying with the rule, which was only partially implemented. But Ed Groshans of Height Securities says financial firms will just keep doing what they've been doing.
So if they're in compliance with the fiduciary rule, they'll stay in compliance. If they were not going to adhere to it fully, they're going to continue to do that.
Groshan says the big firms mostly complied with the fiduciary rule.
You know, they have a team of lawyers that sit down with the compliance staff and say, okay, this is how we're going to go. We're going to implement it this way. And they turn around and do it.
Groshan says it's easier for the big firms to just watch and wait. But he says smaller companies without teams of lawyers won't worry about the fiduciary rule. Now, a part of the rule allowing investors to sue in some cases was never implemented. So what should consumers do now? Boston University law professor Tamar Frankel says, ask your financial advisor direct questions about fees and commissions, like,
should I buy this where you make 1%? Or should I buy that where you make 1% less, but I get more?
Also, she says, read your financial statements. You can even ask your financial advisors to sign a statement saying they'll act in your best interests. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Toys R Us, as you've heard, is going out of business. 735 stores in the United States are going to close. 31,000 people are going to lose their jobs. The Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization comes after a rough decade for the company, loaded down with debt as it was by the private equity companies that bought it back in 2005. Left looking on now, though, are the toy companies whose products used to feature prominently on Toys R Us shelves. Marketplace's Ron Adesego has that one.
I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid.
For those who did grow up with Toys R Us, it was known as the place that sold some unique brands, although the big toy makers had loads of space on the shelves, too. Linda Bolton Weiser is a consumer product analyst with D.A. Davidson. She estimates 8 to 10% of Hasbro and Mattel's annual global sales have come from Toys R Us. That's why, she says, liquidation sales will hurt their bottom line.
In the near term, it does cause a disruption in the business and a reduction in the shipments they'll be able to make into the channel.
The natural move for big brands would be to gravitate toward retailers like Walmart and Target, where there's demand for big brand toys. And the smaller retailers?
There is a possibility, but there's also a lot of competition to get on those shelves.
Jackie Breyer is editor-in-chief of the toy industry site The Toy Book. The beauty of Toys R Us, she says, is that it embraced smaller toy makers and inventors. Those smaller vendors could look to independent toy stores, but those shops have limited shelf space and capacity to take risks on products. Brian Gildenberg, a retail analyst at Kantar Consulting, says that's where the internet comes in. It's where, he says, small toy manufacturers may be better positioned to market themselves.
They're more adept than used to bringing their brands to life in the digital world, which I think will be increasingly the way that toys that aren't the top 500 or 1,000 items in the toy category get sold.
Toys R Us says it has more than 30,000 employees in the U.S., Puerto Rico, and Guam. I'm Renata Sigo for Marketplace.
Let's do this late of a Friday, shall we? Take a step back from all the economic hue and cry and talk about toothpaste, or at least one specific ingredient in a whole lot of toothpastes, mint. Grant Coho from Cambridge, Massachusetts, provided the question for today's installment of our Every Now and Then series, I've Always Wondered.
I've always wondered why it is that mint is so ubiquitous in toothpaste, mouthwash, and the like. Where does mint come from, and what are the economics? You know, is there a massive conspiracy of mint growers in the country?
Well, let's see. A common ingredient in an everyday consumer product, economics, a mint conspiracy? Oh, yeah, we're in. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Here's a 1950s ad jingle to start us off.
You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent. The taste is new, so fresh and clean.
Pepsodent was once the leading toothpaste on the planet, a brand instrumental in creating
a national toothbrushing habit that basically didn't even exist before Claude Hopkins came along.
Charles Duhigg is author of The Power of Habit, and he's talking about the early 20th century ad man, Claude Hopkins. Duhigg says, in the early 1900s, a guy comes to Hopkins to promote this new toothpaste, at a time when hardly anybody brushes. So Hopkins blankets the country with ads warning that a dingy film is covering people's teeth. Brush with Pepsodent, they can have pretty teeth and a movie star smile.
Within 5 years, something like 60% of American households had Pepsodent in their bathrooms.
And one big reason, the inventor of Pepsodent,
he had decided to add a little bit of mint extract. Mint extract, as well as a couple of other ingredients that he added, they're irritants. They cause our tongues and our gum to tingle.
And that tingling
sort of told them that the toothpaste was working, even though it had nothing to do with how the toothpaste actually worked. And people began to equate that tingling feeling with good dental hygiene. And as a result, they began to crave it.
And we still do. It's our main mental association with having a clean mouth and having brushed. Catalina Lee, Worldwide Flavors Director at Colgate-Palmolive, explains how mint's active ingredient, menthol, works.
This menthol is capable to send to the brain a sensation that you have like ice in your mouth without having it. So it's like it tricks your brain.
Colgate-Palmolive is the number one buyer of American mint oil, and Washington State is the biggest producer nationwide. Keen Christensen heads the state's mint commission. His family's farm in Othello, Washington, is about 200 miles east of Seattle. 1,000 acres, not even a big farm by local standards. Fragrant, irrigated green fields spread in every direction, mostly spearmint that'll be ready in late summer.
Harvest it, let it dry, chop it into these wagons that you can haul down the road.
To the barn, where giant metal stills extract the oil.
We hook up a steam line on the bottom, and so inside of here we'll have our mint oil and drain off the water, and then we pump it directly into barrels.
More than 155-gallon barrels, destined for customers like Colgate, Crest, Wrigley's, Cadbury. And what about mint's near-total dominance as a dental flavoring? Colgate's Catalina Lee says it's just consumer preference. There are a few alternatives, like cinnamon and baking soda. Lee says kids like strawberry and other fruit flavors. And mint isn't the number one choice everywhere.
India, they like spices, fennel, amla, neem, or clove. And also in China, they like tea flavors, floral, jasmine is very well liked.
But in the U.S., she says, consumers keep voting with their mouths for the mint. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This whole series doesn't work without you, right? So let us know what you have always wondered. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a commentary of sorts, I guess, on the American consumer this St. Patrick's Day Eve. Americans, report the National Retail Federation, plan to spend $5.9 billion on St. Patty's Day this year. While that digests, we've got more of the numbers from St. Patrick's Day at marketplace.org. Also, this, a public service announcement from our very own Lizzie O'Leary this morning on Twitter, quote, My annual reminder that Daniel O'Leary didn't leave Tipperary in 1836 so you could barf on someone's stoop. Have a little respect tomorrow. Use a trash can. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 72 points on this Friday, 0.2%. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 up 4 points. That's about 0.1%. Let me get it in one more time. The plug for our interview on Monday. Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, or Hank, Ben, and Tim, as I call them, about the financial crisis. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rosdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.